Didn't understand.
Butter off garden.
Sorry, Sue. Good afternoon, committee. On call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. We have three bills on our agenda, actually a bill and two resolutions, and we have two of our colleagues in the audience, and they duked it out, and we're going to begin with HCR 1 and Representative Gelzer. So let me open up public hearing on HCR 1 and ask Representative Gelzer and any guests who you'd like to bring up with you to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelzer, state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I wanted to thank you for giving this bill such a quick hearing upon receiving it. And it really was a great honor for me to be able to submit this resolution to your committee and to this body for consideration this session. We lost one of the most outstanding members of our community last year in the person of Gene Nader. Gene, as you read the resolution, it's very difficult to put into words the many, multiple, extraordinary things that she has done for the community of Corvallis, for the state of Oregon, for the forestry industry, and for women. And that's one of the things that actually stuck out to me most as I learned about Jean. I only had the opportunity to meet her a couple of times in my life, but know her daughter-in-law, Catherine, quite well. But one of the things that's most remarkable to me is that prior to World War II, back in 1940, Jean Nader received a master's degree in chemistry from Cornell University in 1940, which was an extraordinary accomplishment for anyone, but a particularly unusual accomplishment for a woman at that particular time in our history. She immediately put herself to work with those skills, contributing to the World War II effort, devising strategies to combat German U-boats, which also is an extraordinary and remarkable job to be undertaken by a woman in the 1940s. But that, of course, was not enough for Jean. She came and did the most important work of her life when she moved to Corvallis and welcomed her two sons, James and Scott, into her family along with Milt. And then she went to Oregon State to earn a doctoral degree in forest products chemistry from Oregon State College. And she became one of the earliest champions of sustainable forest practices. She and her husband had a small company that grew to be Nader Engineering, which is still a very healthy, thriving, and important business in our community. One of the most important things for the Corvallis community that Jean Nader did was work very hard to bring Hewlett-Packard to the city of Corvallis. Hewlett-Packard today is the largest, or it grew at one point to be the largest private employer in the community and probably the single most generous philanthropic private business in the city of Corvallis. And she did that. There's all these stories about wandering through town, knocking on doors at nighttime. If you've spent much time in Corvallis, we're a place and always have been that really likes our process. And we all have a lot of opinions about how things go. And sometimes that means that processes don't move quickly. And if you want to do something like cite a company like Hewlett-Packard in Corvallis, you need a champion. And Jean Nader was certainly that champion. She continued to break barriers. She was the first woman in the state of Oregon to head a chamber of commerce. She was very active in civic activities, including, and I was talking with a woman at my church this weekend who was a member of the Benton County Republican Women with her, was a very upstanding member of the Republican Party in Benton County at a time when Corvallis and Benton County were a very strongly Republican community, and she described them as Mr. and Mrs. Republican was how she described your mom and dad. But one of the other things that I appreciate, there are many of them, her skill and her contribution was recognized. She's one of only two people to have received both the Corvallis First Citizen Award and the Corvallis Senior First Citizen Award. That was only replicated last month by a man named Hans Newcomb, who's also quite incredible. But what never wavered for Jean was her commitment to her family, to her sons, to her daughters-in-law, to her grandchildren. And she talked to other people about balancing work and family life and being successful as a woman with a career and a business owner and a community activist, and balancing that with family life and treasuring family life. So I wish that I'd had the opportunity to know Jean better. But as a young woman, I look back and think about all the women that came before me that opened up so many doors of opportunity. And Jean Mader was one of those women, opening doors to civic engagement, opening doors for women to be leaders in the business community, opening doors for women to be leaders in science. She's a remarkable woman, and this bill certainly deserves your support. And I've brought with me today her son, James Mader, and her daughter-in-law, Catherine Mader, who each would, I believe, like to say a couple of words about Jean.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're very honored that the legislature would take up a resolution like this. As a son, you know, you get a different view of your parents, I suspect, than other people do. So my childhood recollection of my mother was going to the forest products lab with her and helping her put samples in and out of the dry kilns to do her chemistry doctorate. So that was actually quite fun as a youngster. And then recently, I've had the task of going through her things and sorting them out. She never threw away anything, and so in going through her 400 boxes of business records and her 40 file drawers of clippings and records and her cabinet after cabinet of stuff, I've been singularly impressed by the number of things that she was involved in, the number of articles she wrote, the number of talks she gave. We're actually collecting them, and a very nice lady who is a friend of hers from Altruza in Corvallis has been going through them, and we just sent 95 boxes of records in the forest industry and other things to the OSU archives for them to sort and put into archives for people who want them in the future. We've also given some records to the Adair. My brother-in-law was the engineer on Adair, so those were in her records, and they can use those history of the infrastructure at Adair. And the Benton County Museum will take some of them, and there's some stuff that goes to a military museum, but just an amazing woman in terms of the number of things that she was interested in and involved in. So as going through them, I've been wondering, you know, like, how could we honor her? And I can't think of a better way than to be recognized by the legislature. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, echoing James's discussion of his mother, of course, I had a very different take.
Beverly, you
on
introduce yourself.
Jean, yeah, I'm sorry. My name is Catherine Mader, and I'm daughter-in-law to Jean Mader. I'm also president of Mader Engineering in Corvallis, and I'm director of sustainability for the College of Engineering at Oregon State University. So I was delighted to see that this is being presented before the Environment and Water Committee. It made me just very pleased about that. One thing that perhaps it's always fun to get to know people who have such an extraordinary career, but Jean was actually pretty afraid of one thing, of all the things that she accomplished, and I worked with her day in and day out, and she had many opportunities to run for public office. The one thing that scared her most was doing just that and doing what you're doing. So she, I know, is looking on today and looking at all of you and admiration for what you do and the service that you bring to Oregon, and I'm sure that she is very much appreciative of the honor that you're bestowing on her today, and thank you so much.
She probably had better sense.
She did say that on one of the
Well, thank you very much for being here. Let me see if there are any questions from the committee.
I have one.
Representative.
I'd like to see if we can get
it. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one down here as well.
Age precludes.
Every time, I'm terribly tired.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually heard of your mother and mother-in-law, and it's always a pleasure to do these memorials, resolutions, whatever we call them, to honor people who've gone before us, and I'm always inspired by them, and thank you for being here today, and have a good time going through those things, because my dad died in 95, and I'm still going through some of his things.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to get to know your folks that way.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to see, I don't know what the rules are around amendments in the middle of committee, but on line 23, yes, the first three words, if we could amend the second word on.
you wouldn't want to be there.
No. Cheer.
We know, we do know the rules about amending in committee very well, Representative Smith, and I know you do too. And it is not my intention to accept a motion for an amendment, particularly one on the fly. Well, we really do appreciate you being here and bringing this forward, Representative Gelser, and certainly have our condolences on your loss, but real inspiration for me, and I know other members of the committee, for the life that your mother and mother-in-law lived. So thank you. And we have former Representative Trode. Would you like to speak as well?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Cliff Traw. I used to be the state senator from the Corvallis area, and I've known Gene Mader for a good long time, and I'm especially impressed with line 31, which says Gene Mader possessed indomitable spirit, courage, and generosity, because I saw many examples of that, and I'm really very pleased that we have this concurrent resolution in her honor. I remember her as a 90-year-old woman standing in front of a group in Corvallis on Memorial Day to a group of veterans and families of veterans, talking about reading the poem Flowers on Flanders Field. She did that time and again every year in Corvallis. I remember the flag she gave to the public library and to the Central Park, City Park, and other really fine things that she did. She truly was a leader in the community. You know, you've seen her academic credentials. I know what she did for Oregon State over the years. And I've watched her support many different kinds of activities in our community, always very positively, with a good attitude and making a real contribution. So it's my pleasure to recommend this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here and sharing those memories of her. Anyone else here to testify on this? I don't think so. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on HCR and open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 1. And I will accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Okay. Representative Smith moves HCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any additional discussion on this resolution?
Mr. Chair, with enthusiasm, despite and even perhaps because of line 23.
Very good. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Boone? Aye.
Representative Bent?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. And the motion carries, and HCR 1 is adopted. And Representative Gelser, I assume you'd be willing to carry this bill on the floor.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
Super. Thank you. And I'll close a work session on HCR 1. And let's move into House Bill 2822. So open a public hearing on House Bill 2822. And did Representative Greenlick leave?
I think he just went to get him.
Oh, they went to get him. Okay. So we'll wait for him. There he is. Welcome. You're up.
Can I bring my...
You may. Bring your friends and constituents.
Bring my protection.
See how it goes. He asked that I step out to the bathroom, so
no,
he can share.
No, please stay to protect me. Thank you, Representative Cannon. I'm Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. My staff in the back knows whenever he makes talking points for me to give a talk, it always starts with tell my story, because I think stories are important. But in this case, it was a story that I frankly couldn't believe that led me to this path and to be before you today. And I thought rather than me trying to tell the story, I would let the folks behind me tell the story. And then I'll carry on just a little bit after that.
Yeah, did you want to start?
Is it age before beauty or beauty before age?
I think the age was first.
Okay. I'm going to let you two work that out.
Okay.
I think fathers should always be honored.
All right.
There you go.
Well, I headed this.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Graham Conroy. I live in Portland, Oregon. And I'd headed this to those whom it may concern, which is all of you representatives and honored guests. And hello, I am Graham Conroy, a resident in Northwest Portland. I lived in my present home for the past number of years, purchasing it in 1976. It's a wonderful neighborhood. I've enjoyed its many advantages and friendships in my working years and during my retirement from teaching philosophy at Portland State University. I was there for 3 decades. Everything seemed to be going quite well until a few years ago when my friend and longtime neighbor, Dr. Ron Potts, moved to Moser, selling his house to a Christopher Wilkerson. Relations were on an even keel during the first few years. While there, Chris was married, and the couple gave birth to two children, a boy and a girl. I congratulated him on his marriage and on the birth of the children, and our relations were cordial. But this all changed when I received a handwritten note stuck unsigned into my mailbox demanding that I detach my sewer line from his sewer line, not realizing that there was such a thing as a partnered sewer. His line had been breached and broken near the juncture with the city sewer, just a few feet from it, the juncture, and demanded that I disconnect from his sewer. Put that in capital letters because he said, "What are you doing there? That's my sewer," and so on. And he thought he was the only one keeping it up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this was all news. After this, he said if this wasn't done in X number of days, and I think it was less than a week, he would have the city of Portland come out and do it at my expense. I was shocked and as his outrageous demands were made, and he wanted me to pay for his lawyer's fees and numerous other things that resulted from the break in his sewer. As a result, I became very depressed at his truculence, dishonesty, and mean-spirited behavior. I'm sorry I have to say that. It was necessary to abandon a number of projects that I'd meant to finish during my retirement and meant much to me in a number of ways. It caused me to experience many bad hours and sleepless nights and other times, and even a stroke, worrying about these things and the threat that it would cost me tens of thousands of dollars of my retirement money to meet his unfair demands, or that's what I was told, and resolve these problems. After the city of Portland came up with a solution, my status was alleviated, but I still felt myself a victim to his rancor and hostile attitude. Since replanting a new sewer line, I have found other friends and acquaintances with similar problems and have talked to many of them. Many or more of them even on just subsistence money or facing hostile neighbors as well, one of whom sold his house and moved just recently to another city. And among these were friends in the Northwest neighborhood. The Northeast neighborhood, pardon me. Can't read my own writing. I do hope and pray that the city and the state can come up with rules and laws that can obviate these kind of problems and relieve citizen anxieties in the future. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jillian Conroy, and I'm Graham Conroy's daughter. So my role in this, besides working for Hewlett-Packard, so that was interesting in the last part, but I've been helping my dad out with working through the sewer issues, working with Representative Greenlick, the city commissioners, a number of different things. So I'll just go through some of the issues that we had and where this is a really critical issue for us. We've had our problems resolved, but watching my dad go through the health problems that he did at the time, well, he's 83, so imagine that you have this happening. Yeah, and you have this happening, and somebody's getting ready to take away everything you ever worked for. So that was the position we were in, and this went on for nearly 2 years. So good afternoon, House Representatives and Chair Cannon. Thank you for letting me speak on this. One of the things that came out of it, in the 1800s, when this sewer was originally put in, the party sewer, it was really a handshake that you had for an easement. So they're typically single property owners that own multiple properties, and then they would work out the easements. I don't think they ever believed that 107 years later people would be able to extort money from one another based on that handshake agreement, and that's the situation we found ourselves in. Greed is a powerful motivator, and one of the concerns is when we set up an environment that allows somebody to have those tools to do that, that's something that we should avoid at all costs. In 2007, my dad found out about the party sewer, as he said, when it broke. What ended up happening is Chris Wilkerson had a tree that was planted on top of the sewer. So when you have a party sewer, imagine it comes down from my dad's house, branches out from Chris's, and goes to the street. So my dad is on the less desirable part of not being next to the main sewer, which is not the good position to be in this situation. And so Chris actually had a tree go through the sewer, and that's when doing the scope, how we found out that it was a party sewer. So my dad, you know, having lived there since 76, didn't even have any idea we were on a party sewer. And when that happened, as my dad said, Chris went to him and said, actually, I think it was more like 48 hours that he had to be off. But it was not only that it would be finished at the state's, or rather at my dad's cost from the city, but that they were going to do a capping permit. So let me kind of fast forward to a couple of the key issues. So BDS was talking to us about grandfathering my dad. So, okay, we have this party sewer. We have some rules that had changed in, I think it was in the 1980s, and how can we make this work? Well, what ended up happening is that Chris had the right to decide whether or not my dad could be grandfathered. So BDS could say, you can fix the party sewer and keep it, but then my dad's neighbor said no. And basically, really, it was extortion at that point because he knew that my dad's other option was to build the city project. So to take, you have Northrop and Marshall, which run down both sides. My dad's house is the second one in, so it's essentially landlocked. There is no sewer on 24th Avenue. And so my dad had two ways of getting there. He could either go past two more houses and go out to the other side if they would all agree to provide easements, or he could go to the street on 24th, and it was going to have to be a city sewer project that he would have to fund on his own, which could be anywhere from, you know, $50,000 up to $100,000, because there were also water pipes, and there was a vitrine clay pipe as well, and he would have to do all of these enhancements, and it would be billed to my dad. So he would have lost every penny of any retirement he had. And after being a World War II vet and also a 30-year professor, you know, to just see everything wiped out, it was, like I said, on his health, it was really shattering. The other issue, on besides being landlocked and having somebody being allowed to extort money, and I won't even get into the numbers, but it just got to be ridiculous what he was doing. The other issue is on the capping permit. So it was one of those things where my dad wasn't handing over money to him, so he was looking for other means. So when he found out about this capping permit, he went to BDS, and they issued a permit which basically said that he could cap off my dad's sewer, so he would no longer have sewer access on that party line. Now, I called multiple states around, Idaho, I believe Washington, Montana, and I started asking the different states, do you do this type of thing? Everybody said the only reason you do that is if you're doing a tear down of a house or some kind of demolition or reconstruction, that you don't give a capping permit just because a neighbor wants to be aggressive with someone who's, you know, in a more difficult position. And it was issued, and within 30 days, my dad was going to be cut off from the sewer. And mind you, he's been paying sewer bills for, you know, since 1976. So what ended up happening is, you know, like I said, I went to Representative Greenlick, the commissioners, and going through other folks. And we finally came up with a resolution, but not because anything was pulled on the capping permit. There was nothing that could be done about that. And what I was told at that time was that if that capping permit went through, my dad's choice would be to have to build that sewer because he probably couldn't be able to do, you know, any kind of a temporary system like a septic because it's within, you know, the location where it is. And his other option would be if he did nothing, he would be cited by BDS, and then his house would eventually be condemned. So he could sell. He was told he could actually sell his house to resolve it. So, yeah, it was spiraling out of control pretty fast. And then, you know, as I said, we, you know, luckily BES came through, had some great solutions, working with Representative Greenlick, with Randy Leonard and Sam Adams, the city commissioner's offices and their staffs. We were able to come up with a solution very much like what is being requested and crafted as a future solution. So we're not in a position where we need our situation fixed, but I would never, ever, ever want to put somebody through that. It was pure hell, and you're in the hands of somebody who, just by virtue of the fact that they bought the house closer to the sewer, that they are basically, they have the sole seat at the bargaining table when that happens. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. And we'll see in a moment whether there are any follow-up questions. But first, Representative Greenlick.
And just to see the other side of the story, I was talking to my brother, who has a house on Savior and 27th, just a few blocks away. Excellent. And he happened to be mentioning something. If I needed a sewer person, I had a really good sewer person. I said, what happened? They said, well, we have a problem with our sewer. The city needs to straighten it out. And also, there are three houses behind us that are connecting to the sewer through our sewer system there in this shared sewer. And I said, oh, how's it working? They said, oh, it's working fine. I said, well, what did you do? He said, we gave them easements, of course. I mean, they have to get to the sewer. I said, did you charge them for the easement? They said, charge for an easement? I mean, they have to get to the sewer, right? I mean, it can happen. This could easily have been avoided. There was absolutely no need for this to happen. So what the city, I think, has come up with what's a very simple solution to this. I won't try and explain it to you. You know, anything connected to water is complicated, so let even brown water. So let them explain it. But I think it is a relatively simple thing. I think there's no opposition to what we're going, and I hope you move this bill to save this kind of anguish from other folks.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, are we going to hear from somebody who can talk about the technicals of the
yeah.
bill?
Yeah, we have folks from
right
thank
now.
You. Then I won't ask.
Right. I certainly
then.
Won't.
Then I won't ask a question. Thank you.
I do have a question for the Comrades. How's this story does say a lot about your neighbor, and it's unfortunate that laws like this are necessary. Mm-hmm. Frankly. How's your relationship with him today?
I don't know, you may have seen the story on the news on Channel 2 around the 4th of July. Do you remember the neighbor that tore up a driveway of his 83-year-old next-door neighbor to build a cedar fence down the middle of it? That's him. So we're...
It kept on going.
Okay.
So unfortunately, we're in litigation, and luckily we're in settlement for that. Unfortunately, his opening these cans of worms turned out the neighbor behind, wonderful woman, and she found out that a lot of his newly built items are on her property. So she's demanding he tears them down now. So there's a little bit of karma, I think, in that
reaction. I'll say. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just Representative Greenlick, I am not surprised that you would help them in the way you have, because that's. But I am surprised that you missed a revenue opportunity with your brother. It's not like you.
I offered to buy his house so I could charge $50,000 for his neighbors to come through it, but he wouldn't sell. No, I mean, it really is an issue of good neighbors. There really is no excuse for this sort of thing, but the law needs to make it not easy for this crazy kind of thing to happen.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
I thought, why me? But then, on the other hand, why not me? The world is open.
I thought so.
Things happen. And bad things happen to good people, and maybe good things happen to bad people.
You've been a philosophy professor.
But the gentleman that used to be there before, who had moved in a year before I moved into my house, we were very good friends, and we never had a bit of trouble.
Ron's also a good friend of mine.
Oh, you know Ron?
Yeah, Ron's a good friend of mine.
And he's a great piano player, too.
He's a fantastic.
I could sit on my front porch and listen to him practicing. So it was like having your own musician in residence.
Well, sorry that...
This was a total flip-flop, by the way.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your experience. And we'll hear now from...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Green. Like, we kept you out of your committee for... Perhaps not quite as long as you would have liked. But
I can go listen to Napoleon.
Yeah. Better you than me. We'll hear now from the City of Portland.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Director for the City of Portland, and I'm here today to speak on House Bill 2822, and after what you just heard, I think we should start to refer to this as the Nightmare on Elm Street legislation. It does have a rather benign-sounding title, Authorizing Ways of Necessity for Temporary Sewer Connections, but as you just heard, it really does affect real people in real serious ways. Just want to clarify in the story you just heard that there were two organizations of the City of Portland involved. The BDS, the Bureau of Development Services, is the organization that handles the plumbing code and building code. And they were the organization that was, when you heard references to a capping permit and the plumbing code, they were the folks dealing with the implementation of the plumbing code. When they referred to BES, that's Environmental Services, that's us, we were the ones who finally arrived to fix this problem. And I will get into more of that discussion later. But as was pointed out, it seems as though everybody either has this problem or knows of somebody that has this problem. There are well over 3,000 properties in Portland, and I believe the map you just received on the flip side has red dots for the properties that we are aware of. There are no doubt more to come as people move to sell their house, try to sell their house and move, and the prospective buyers do an inspection and discover that they have a party sewer. Or people develop a plumbing problem, and when the plumber is called, they come out and discover the problem in that way. So there are really a lot of innocent victims here. The people involved 100 years ago that built these homes are no longer to be found. It's not, however, limited to Portland. We are well aware of problems throughout the state. We've talked to folks in Sweet Home and Gresham and Prineville and Ontario and Central Point and Jacksonville and other communities all over this state that are wrestling with this problem. When it's discovered right now, as you just heard, there is either, and you just heard both sides of it, there are opportunities for people to be truly good neighbors and work out a quick and amicable settlement, and there are opportunities for just the opposite to happen. And I'd like to think that everybody's going to be a good neighbor, but I think what we've heard and what we've experienced in our hometown of Portland, it's not always the case. And what we're trying to do here is provide an avenue by which, if things go wrong, people have a way to resolve this matter that doesn't break the bank. And right now, we were able to provide some assistance in this case, and we are jumping around the city from hotspot to hotspot as someone says to us, I can't sell my house, it's on the market, no one will buy it, can you please come out and extend the sewer so I can sell my house? It is a very disorganized, disorderly, and expensive way of solving this problem. We have established a 20-year, $30 million sewer extension program to move methodically around the city to address these concerns block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. We have estimated that it will probably add about $10 million to the expense if we have to still fight these fires on a house-by-house basis, solving one owner's squabble after another. So I think what 2822 does is it provides an orderly, fair, and cost-effective solution to a situation that we confront. this, what this bill does specifically, and if you'd like, you can look at this chart that shows the actual properties for some examples. Just really quickly, example A is property owner A and B, and you'll notice they have apparently no sewer connection. And that's simply a reflection of the fact that there are many houses in this state for which we have no plumbing records, and the owners have no idea how they're connected to the sewer. And as the Conroys pointed out, they were paying sewer charges for years and had no idea that they were connected to the sewer through their neighbor's property. So A and B someday will discover either that they're crossing their neighbor to the left or the neighbor to the right. Party C, there in example two, we do have information, and they clearly have a party sewer. You can see that they're connected right through their neighbor's side yard. Now, again, they may be able to work out a deal and get an easement, in which case they can buy it. They could sell that house, and probably nobody would care, and they could move on with their life. But they also might face the prospect of their neighbor saying, no, get your pipe off my property and or pay me an exorbitant amount of money. And what they would do is call up the city and say, can you please extend that sewer, which you see in example three, where at some point in the past the city extended that sewer a few hundred feet up the street in order to provide service to 3620. But what you see is, and I have no idea why this happened, but if the sewer line had been extended another 100 feet, they could have provided service to the other houses on that block. But it's probably an example of it was a case-by-case solution. 3620 had the problem, and nobody else reported a problem, so the fix was only partially done. Just looking at 2822 itself, we think it's pretty targeted. We looked at the least invasive mechanism by doing this, which is we identified the current way of necessity statute. It's a part of the law that's well known for providing people access to landlocked properties. This provides sewer access to properties that are do not otherwise have public sewer available to them. And the only way they can get it is to continue the use of their sewer connection across somebody else's property. So it has to meet that test. It has to be in a jurisdiction that has a sewer extension program of some kind. It has to be a temporary in that once public sewers are accessible to the property owner, they have 6 months to connect, and then the way of necessity expires. And they do have to pay reasonable compensation. So if someone has to apply and request a way of necessity, they have to provide appraisals to identify what the appropriate compensation is to the landowner. So we think it provides fair treatment for everyone and provides the kind of certainty that is necessary sometimes to solve these problems. Now, my hope is that this doesn't ever have to get used, because if the tool is available, I think the neighbors can then be counseled to reach an agreement and do what's right, because otherwise your neighbor can create this vehicle, and why put everybody through that anguish? But in those cases, and perhaps we just heard an example of one where it may have had to have been used, and it would be available. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to conclude my testimony and answer any questions that you may have.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Marriott. I can't tell you how relieved I am that you're not the neighbor, as I was sitting there listening to the other testimony. Wondered if that was you. When does the clock start if you were going to invoke this, if we passed it the way it is? And why do you think 6 months is enough?
Let me be clear. The clock would start as far as when the way of necessity would apply. The person asking for the way of necessity has to assemble essentially an application for a way of necessity and submit it. Once granted, they would have the way of necessity until the public sewer is available to them. At that point, once they are notified by the community, by the service provider, either the city or the utility, then they have 6 months to conclude the way of necessity. I think at that point the neighbor could exercise the right to if necessary, to eject the person's line if they failed to act. But I know in Portland the city would require them to disconnect and connect to the public sewer.
Okay.
So can I clarify?
Yes.
So the temporary nature of this is sort of dependent on the city actually bringing the public sewer line to the affected residents. So if, for instance, I'm on one of these party line sewers and I need to apply for a temporary way of necessity, I have that way of necessity, assuming my application is correct. I am granted that way of necessity for as long as it takes for the city to bring out public sewer access, at which point I have 6 months to connect to the public sewer. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Yes.
President Bernhardt?
Thank you. I have several questions, if I may.
Absolutely.
Let's start at the bottom. I'm looking at the end of the bill, Section 4, working backwards. How do you calculate what compensation ought to be paid to the owner? How would that be figured out?
Well, Representative Barnard, the statute calls for the applicant to provide an appraisal, and easements for utilities are appraised all the time, so they would have to submit.
There is appraisal. A standard that an appraiser could use to determine what that easement would be worth.
Yes, that's correct.
What provisions are there, if any, in this law for maintenance of the common portions of the sewer line? I'm looking, for example, at C, where there's a portion of the what must presumably be the private sewer in the boundaries of the street where the two sewers are connected. Presumably both 5040 or 50, I'm not sure what the number is, 5040 and 3614 are using that common portion of the private sewer line together. What provisions, if any, does this kind of rule deal with a situation in which that portion of the sewer line required repair? And who would bear the cost of that?
Representative Barnard, if I understand your question, when the private lateral enters the public right-of-way, it becomes the public jurisdiction's obligation.
So I'm wrong about that. That portion of the line is actually part of the city's responsibility.
At least in Portland, once it's in the right-of-way, the city takes responsibility.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Well, it might. Let's suppose a slightly different situation in which there aren't two sewer lines running across 5040, but only one once the line from 3614 connected to it. Who would then be responsible for the maintenance of that common sewer line on the private property before it reached the city street? And how would that be apportioned if it would be? There's nothing in the bill that refers to that issue.
Right, that's right.
Would that be under some other law, or how would that be done?
Well, Representative Barnard, the
of course, I'm dealing with a situation we're in where we have an uncooperative neighbor
right. Who
wants to cause trouble. And so you got to have a rule that covers the situation.
My understanding is the state plumbing code requires these lines to be adequately, properly maintained so that, for instance, in Portland, that's what often happens when someone discovers they have a plumbing problem. They notify the city, and the city gives them a certain period of time in which to correct it in order to avoid a public health problem or a public nuisance. So the property owner, let's say that parcel owner C crosses their neighbor's backyard and then connects to the public sewer. So
the example we have here.
So parcel owner C would be obligated to maintain that line, even though it's not on their property. So if a problem was discovered and the parcel owner C decided to ignore it, it would be up to the municipality to enforce the plumbing code to require that be adequately maintained.
Okay, now the second example I give, where the two private sewer line actually joined with each other.
Yes.
For a portion of the distance, not the example C, but something similar to that.
Yes.
Who would be responsible for maintaining the common portion of the sewer line where the effluent from both houses was moving through the private portion of the sewer line?
Well, Representative Barnhart, it's an excellent question. And in Portland, I can tell you how it would work, is the city would notify both owners. Because if it was an existing party sewer, the city would say, if the problem is below the the why, and it's both of your responsibilities. And they would be given a time frame in which to get it done, or the city would send a crew out, repair it, and put a lien on their property. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that that's done in every municipality, but that's how we would do it.
Okay, it occurs to me, Mr. Chair, that this may be a problem with the bill in that situation. If there isn't some way of apportioning the cost, then I can imagine in a situation that our first witness was in might very well lead to additional litigation just to figure out who had to pay the bill. The next question I have, if I may.
Yes,
thank you.
Go ahead, Representative.
Could you tell us what B on lines 29 and 30 means? And specifically, I'm thinking about a temporal situation. Right now, we're dealing with 5040, I presume, is the property that we're talking about. And at some time later, during the time that there continues to be use of the sewer line across that property, there is some permitted development or redevelopment under the terms of B. Once this right of necessity, way of necessity is granted, does it necessarily stop a permitted development or redevelopment from occurring? This appears to suggest that you can't grant the way of necessity when these things are happening, but it doesn't suggest what would happen if the development or redevelopment were to occur after the way of necessity had been granted. Do you know what the rule would be in that situation?
Well, Representative Barnard, I'm not an expert on that situation, but the way I understand it would be that once the way, if you qualify for the way and it's granted, in other words, there's mm-hmm. not a permitted expansion or development plan, that you then have essentially an easement, and you would have the rights to enforce that easement. If someone wanted to build an addition on their house or tear down their house and build a new house and move into the space of the easement, they would frankly need to negotiate with you a solution.
Okay. I think I'm down to my last question. I think what this way of necessity is then is an easement,
yeah.
except that it has a condition that there not be a sewer line available for the land from the city.
Okay.
Once that happens, then that way of necessity expires in 6 months. Have I understood that correctly?
I believe that.
Otherwise, I can think of this as an easement.
It sort of acts like and walks like and talks like an easement. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's all of my questions.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, maybe minor historical question. Looking at your helpful map with the red lights, how come the red lights go dark at 205, or maybe it's 82nd? And is that merely because we started doing newer sewers, the state, the city, whomever started doing newer sewers, 82nd and east, or is there some other reason for that?
Representative Smith, that's exactly right. You've put your finger on it. As that's the Mid-County Sewer Project. In the early 1990s, the city of Portland annexed a lot of that land and built sewers, put over 50,000 houses that were on septic systems or cesspools onto public sewers. We hope to think we did it right, which is why you don't see any red dots to speak of out
there. It's one of the benefits your constituents enjoy now that they are citizens of the city of great city of Portland.
And let me say, my citizens are so happy about that. So much so that I need to say for the record that the annexation of Multnomah County was deemed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to be unconstitutional, and the only reason that is not stuck is because on remand the court found that there was no remedy. So that is true. Right now, you only have that plot of land within your fair city because of an unconstitutional act by the city of Portland, and someday we will raise cavalry against you.
May we cut off your sewer if that happens?
Depends who wins, man. That's how that works. My other question is section, and I think the answer to my question might be section 4, paren 2. But if I were a judge or advising one, I don't think this would constitute a taking, at least in the traditional sense. But I'd like to be certain of it, and I'd like to be able to answer that question well. Is the answer to that question section 4, paren 2, or something else instead?
Is it just that it's not a taking, or?
Well, Representative Smith, we believe it's not a taking because, again, following the model established for other similar things, ways of necessity, compensation is required. In order for you to get the way of necessity, you have to compensate the adjacent property owner fair market value for the easement.
Okay. Thank you.
It turns out I do have another question.
You do.
I apologize.
And you may go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is that easement likely to cost, round numbers?
Representative Barnhart, my experience in Portland is that we're talking about, if it went across a residential lot, something in the area of $2,000 to $3,000.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. And a couple of questions of mine. Why lines 19 through 21, why do we limit this to cities or jurisdictions that have that are in the process of extending their public sewers? Does that get it? I mean, the fact that this allows it not to be quite an easement and instead to be a temporary right of necessity. What's the significance of why did you limit it that way?
Yes, Chair Cannon, we tried again to make this as limited duration as possible. We didn't want to give people the impression that the home community could sit on its hands and do nothing to remedy the situation. That if that was the case, then the affected property owners should contact their local elected officials to encourage them to get with it. And
my last question, anyway, does this bill take care of the capping problem that we heard? Would this prohibit, and if so, how, the bad neighbor from capping or threatening to cap the private sewer line that goes through their land?
Chair Kennan, we believe that this does provide a mechanism by which a capping permit would not have to issue. In other words, before we started looking at a solution, I sat down with the officials in Portland who manage the plumbing code, and I asked them, how can we avoid this capping permit? Because it's you issuing the capping permit that triggers all of these really bad things, and they told me they had explored every option, and the only thing they can do is to delay issuing the capping permit for some period of time, otherwise they could not simply fail to issue a capping permit because the person comes in and says they have a sewer line on my property, I want it out of there. We believe this would provide a remedy for the affected property owner.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, just for clarification. Would this bill have any effect on infill development within the city where you have multiple residences that have a newer party line sewer that comes together to a common pipe on commonly owned private land?
Representative Bailey, you know, I hadn't actually thought of that. If it's a newer system, then the sewers provided to that development would have to meet the plumbing code standards, would not be what we would traditionally call a party sewer. They would either be a private sewer system entirely, or they would have been dedicated to the public. So if it's a private sewer system, I would imagine any infill development would want to tie into the private sewer system. It would not be a public problem. I can't think of how this would affect infill development adversely or necessarily promote it. But I haven't given it a lot of thought. I'd be happy to do more of that if it's an issue that's troubling you.
I'd just be curious, Mr. Chair, to follow up and get some clarification. I live in one of those in the city of Portland, so I'm just curious.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Vandenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having grown up in the city of Portland and now living in the country way outside any kind of city, I'm really glad I don't have to deal with this kind of thing. I have great neighbors. Very lucky to have great neighbors.
Representative Barker.
Most of these issues that you're talking about are come up with lots and sewer systems that were established in the neighborhood of 100 years ago or more, aren't they?
Yes, Representative Barnhart. It's just the way the pipes age, they're reaching the end of their useful life. This
well, I guess
is the lateral
I'm asking a different question. Really, it's a legal question. The handshake easement that we were discussing earlier was done then. Nobody would try to do that kind of thing now in a development, would they?
I hope not.
Legal, recorded statement about where the pipes were, who owned them, who was responsible for maintaining them, all of those kinds of things.
Yes, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly right. All of the development now has to follow this, the provisions of making sure the plat is recorded, has all the utilities on it marked, as-built plans filed, and so forth. So this is a historical legacy from usually pre-World War II.
So this is not the kind of a problem that would ever come up with more recent construction where those niceties of recording, documenting and recording were followed.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just share with us the access to a public road phrase? And I think you may have mentioned it earlier, and I'm sorry I wasn't listening closely enough. It looks as though the concept of the statute is that there be access to a public road. Does access mean adjacent to or some distance from? What's access mean?
Representative Bench, you're talking about Section 4 of the bill where it says...
I think it's on Section 1.
It's in Section 1 initially. Section 1 definitions 2C, line 16, 17.
What I believe we're trying to get at here is that... that the situation is ultimately curable in that there is, if you get public sewer down a public street, that someone can cure the problem by then tapping into the sewer line and do away with the need for the way of necessity. If they were truly landlocked, then this way of necessity might have to continue infinitely. So we're not trying to solve that person's problem. If they literally are landlocked, they have more problems than this legislation is going to solve for them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up, Representative.
I'm just trying to get at the clarity of the definition. So for purposes maybe of this record, your remarks would establish that it's that there be legal access to a public road, that is, or just... there's all kinds of access, of course. There's run across somebody's yard, and that's access, or a driveway, that's access, or they're built right on the road, that's access. But I just want to get at your thinking and what was your... because it appears twice. It seems to be the basis for the entire device, access. So I just want to hear what you think that is.
Well, I can, Representative Benz, I'm trying to explain, perhaps not very artfully, that what we intended was that this problem could be cured when public sewers are brought to a road that the owner has physical access to for their sewer and doesn't have to indefinitely maintain this way of necessity. Now, they may have some other legal means of gaining access to that public road, which would be great, but that they don't have to rely on this way of necessity tool indefinitely. So maybe there's some vagary there that needs to be clarified, but that's certainly what we intended. I hope I'm being able to answer your question. But
Actually, no, because the access has so many different... Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
It has many different meanings, and so I just want to avoid a situation where someone says, oh, you don't have access in the sense that term is being used in the statute, therefore it's not available to you. So that's why access, because it has different meanings, needs to be clear, or this will not work. That's why I'm asking. So, but I haven't heard yet exactly how access would be defined, because it means a lot of things. So that's my point. And you could be resolved by adding something to the definitional section that defines access for purposes of this device.
Any further questions? Seeing none, is there anyone here who would like to testify who hasn't spoken already. Mr. Eisenbeiss, you want to say anything on the bill? Okay. Great. In that case, let me close the public hearing. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2822. And I'll take a motion. We'll discuss. We'll see whether we've got the support to move it along or whether we need to have a look for an amendment. But why don't we get a motion on the bill, and then we can enter discussion. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2822 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2822 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I am prepared to vote for this bill and move it out of committee. I wanted to say for the record that my question related more to a possible declaration of conflict of interest on the floor, and so I will be following up after this committee to be able to understand whether or not that conflict exists.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barker?
Thank you. I'm wondering if the last line of question and answers leads any of the members to wonder if this bill needs an amendment.
Representative Ben Stewart.
Well, I guess it's...
I had trouble following it, and that's the reason I asked the question.
I probably haven't spent enough time studying it. I would just say that the way I read it, in 2C, you're not going to... This device is not going to be available unless we are working on a continuation of a pre-existing sewer service to land that has access to a public road. So the question becomes, what is access to a public road? And if what is access? Is it access for the sewer? Is it access for the driveway? Is it access for the yard? Is it access for the kids? What is it? Now, the testimony we heard may be sufficient to shore this up in case this issue is ever addressed in a lawsuit, because we'll have the testimony on the record that access means access, I guess what I heard. But the issue is, are we accomplishing our purpose by leaving it in this fashion, in this form? So, because the entire device rests on land having access to a public road.
Right. And my understanding, the intent of that is because we are trying to limit this to circumstances where the city, the jurisdiction, is likely to bring the public sewer line to that residence under its program of extending public sewer lines via the that road. So we're not. So this is not impacting or does not provide a solution for somebody who is truly landlocked in the sense they do not have access to a public road because they're not going to get a public sewer system extension.
Well,
President Benz.
I think we should. Yes, and the debate we are now having may provide ground sufficient for anyone that looks at this dialogue to say, well, the legislature meant what you just said, access, and therefore this property not being landlocked may use this statute to resolve its difficulties. So we have said it. You just said it. I just said it. We now have it in the record, and maybe this will take the place of the need for the amendment.
How many attorneys do we have on this committee?
Too many.
Three too many.
There are four.
Jules is an attorney.
Four?
Three.
Three.
How many petitions do we have?
Any other comment on this? My view as a non-attorney, but one that relies on the guidance of legislative counsel, who of course drafts these bills for us, is that given their work on this bill and given the discussion we've had here today, there is sufficient clarity. I mean, as I read it as a layperson, it seems it's clear enough to me, at least, what is meant by access. But again, that's the non-legal opinion, but one informed by the work of the attorney who has drafted the bill and the attorneys undoubtedly at the City of Portland who have also spent time with this language. My view is that we have enough clarity here to move forward, but I'm certainly open. I mean, we're not under a deadline of 5 o'clock today, so if I thought this would
this would make folks sleep a little bit better tonight by getting an amendment, then.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to vote for it, having had this discussion.
Great.
It doesn't rise to the level of clarity we enjoy in Eastern Oregon matters. But it's fine for the city of Portland.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting little wrinkle on this bill. It occurs to me that even a landlocked piece might end up with access to a public road by way of the rule of necessity involving roadways under Section 2, the first portion of Section 2 that describes in great detail how one goes about getting access to a public way if you're landlocked. It doesn't appear to me, just reading this quickly, that that's limited temporally. And then once one established as a landlocked property, established the access to the public road under the way of necessity, then one could go ahead, because one now had access to a public road, to establish a rule of necessity sewer service. So that might not be a problem anyway.
Certainly probably not a problem for the affected property owner. Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, I am not an attorney, but I do have a degree in psychology, and my clinical determination of this issue is whenever you can get an Eastern Oregon attorney to want to do less paper work, go with it.
I take that counsel. Well, in that case, seeing no further discussion, will the clerk please call the roll?
Yeah.
Representative
Bailey. Aye.
Representative
Farner. Aye. Representative Benson.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilley.
Aye.
Chair Kent.
Aye. Motion carries. And could we get a motion to put it on the consent calendar?
Mm-hmm. You don't want to talk about
Mr.
this.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2822 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I move that it be proceed to the consent calendar.
Okay, so the motion is to place the bill on the consent calendar. Probably could have done it in that one single motion, but on this motion to place the bill on the consent calendar, is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. With that, we'll close the work session on HB 2822, and we are going to stand at ease for a moment.
call the committee back to order, but not for long, members, because we are missing our chief proponent and only scheduled speaker for SCR 5, so we're going to have to hold off on that. We'll repost it for another day. So for today, committee is adjourned.
Well, that was nice. Yeah.